The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 8, 2026 edition of Time Magazine. Today's cover features, as usual, the red border with a white narrow inner border. Time in large block capital lettering is superimposed in dark gray upon a lighter gray background. Time is slightly interfered with by the head of the person who's featured on the cover. It's a photograph of Dana White, the promoter. How Dana White Took the UFC from the Fringes to the White House by Sean Gregory. I will be reading that in this hour. Dana White is not looking at the camera. He's in profile. He's looking down as if he were looking at the floor, I guess. His head is bald or shaved. He is Caucasian. It's a shadowy photograph, so I cannot tell you his eye color. His mouth is slightly open. It is not smiling nor frowning. He's wearing black. It appears to be a black jacket or suit coat and a black shirt with a collarless shirt. Beginning with the brief news, The High Price of Attending the World Cup by Sean Gregory. There is the viral ad from Canadian carrier Air Transat, TRANSAT, showing how much cheaper it is to fly to some countries than attend their soccer games at the World Cup. Watch England tickets at $3,402. See England round trip tickets starting at $779. Then there are the eye-popping asking prices on the World Cup secondary market. In mid-May, on FIFA's resale platform, the cheapest ticket for the July 19 World Cup final at MetLife Stadium outside New York City was going for $9,200. The richest asking price, $11,499,998.55. Good luck shedding that one, pal, is in parentheses. And don't forget the brouhaha over train fare. NJ Transit announced in April it would charge fans $150 to get from Penn Station to MetLife on game days, a round trip that typically costs around $13. In May, it cut the price to $98. The 2026 World Cup, co-hosted by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, is costing a small fortune for both spectators and local governments tasked with welcoming international soccer fans. Football unites the world, FIFA is fond of boasting, but this year's tournament risks bringing together fans of a certain tax bracket while pricing out some of the game's most passionate supporters. FIFA has embraced the sort of dynamic pricing customers find when shopping for airline tickets. Costs fluctuate in real time based on demand. In May, for example, it was charging at face value $1,940 for an upper-tier seat to the opener for the U.S. men's national team, a game against Paraguay at SoFi Stadium in Englewood, California, June 12th. And FIFA's own resale site charges both buyer and seller an additional 15%, increasing the soccer body's haul as seats change hands. There's some element of greed there, says Kate Ashley, a professor at Northeastern University's Damore McKim School of Business. To justify this model, FIFA president Gianni Infantino has pointed to the robust U.S. resale market. Since tickets are likely to sell above face value on a secondary platform, the organization is trying to match those numbers in initial sale price as much as possible. FIFA's approach could backfire. Plenty of tickets remain unsold. Anyone up for the $1,300 front-level tickets for the Haiti-Scotland group stage matchup in Foxborough, Massachusetts, June 13, plus sticker shock may be deterring travelers from making the trip. According to a report from the American Hotel and Lodging Association, released in early May, close to 80% of survey respondents across U.S. host cities said bookings are tracking below initial expectations. Forecasts show domestic travelers are outpacing international travelers, the report concluded, which is concerning for metro areas betting on an economic boost. International visitors spend money in hotels, restaurants, and shops that would not otherwise be spent. Thankfully, fans can still hack this pricey World Cup. Over the 30-day period prior to May 19, secondary market prices dropped more than 20% on average for group stage matches, according to TicketData.com. You could keep waiting it out for even better deals. Host cities are also staging free fan fests and watch parties at places like Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta. It is great to be inside the stadium at a match, says Lee Eigel, a professor at NYU's Tisch Institute for Global Sport. Sometimes it's equally great to be outside the stadium or further away from the stadium and just be around people who are enjoying themselves around this sport. Like at the pub, that classic World Cup locale, sharing an experience with other rabid supporters in front of a big screen. $10 pitchers instead of $2,000 seats. There have been worse backup plans. Now, this little article is accompanied by a small, colorful photograph. It looks like red, all over red. Raked seating in this open-air stadium with lots of red seats. Down on the field, there's a big green rectangle. Off in the distance, there's a blue sky. The caption reads, "The home of the Kansas City Chiefs is hosting 6 World Cup games." What is missing in this photo, perhaps in preparation for the World Cup games, is the iconic Kansas City Chiefs logo. I think it features an arrow with something. Okay, turning the page to milestones, I'll read the long articles first. Aired, A-I-R-E-D, The Late Show's Last Bow. Stephen Colbert Says Good Night by Rebecca Soffer, S-O-F-F-E-R, who is a former producer of The Colbert Reports. Stephen Colbert took over The Late Show from its original host, David Letterman, in 2015, and in the years between then and the show's final episode, which aired May 21, he achieved something extraordinary, making it normal to talk about the hardest parts of being alive. Colbert was not just funny. He had a way of revealing the full scope of a guest's humanity. He created moments where difficult human experiences were not packaged into something easier to sit with or made tidy. They stayed there, unresolved in front of millions, like his 2021 interview with actor Andrew Garfield, who spoke about grieving his mother, or one of Colbert's many conversations with Anderson Cooper, reflecting on the deaths of Cooper's parents with a clarity that did not rush toward closure. Colbert himself often returned to the loss of his father and brothers in a plane crash when he was a child, as well as his mother's death. These moments did not resolve. They did not pivot neatly back to promotion or punchlines. They simply existed, often sandwiched between humorous and sometimes absurd segments. Television often struggles to hold difficult human experience unless it can be shaped into something digestible, or it is reserved for moments of collective catastrophe. In last year's acceptance speech, after winning his Emmy for Outstanding Talk Series, Colbert shared how he had set out to make a late-night show about love, but later realized we were doing a late-night comedy show about loss. And that's related to love, because sometimes you only truly know how much you love something when you get a sense you might be losing it. In his decades of late-night television, Colbert showed love and loss are inseparable. Lost, Elon Musk, OpenAI lawsuit, by Nikita Ostrovsky. A California jury dealt a blow to Elon Musk's AI ambitions May 18 by rejecting his lawsuit against his competitor and one-time associate Sam Altman, objecting to OpenAI turning for profit. Musk sued in 2024. The jury found statutory deadlines had been exceeded. Musk has said he will appeal. If the suit had proceeded, OpenAI and its partner Microsoft could have owed up to roughly $150 billion in damages, and Altman might have been removed from OpenAI's board. Instead, Musk's own AI company looks weaker than ever, says analyst Peter Wildeford. During the trial, Musk seemed to admit that SpaceX AI partly trains its chatbot on OpenAI's models, a strategy often adopted by lagging AI companies. SpaceX AI agreed to rent all of the computing capacity at one of its flagship data centers to competitor Anthropic. In an acrimonious AI race, the verdict is the latest sign that Musk may be falling behind the pack. Now, moving to the left-hand column, where there are 2, 4, 5 entries. 1, WON, the Eurovision Song Contest by Bulgaria's Dara, May 16, marking the country's first win since the international music competition began in 1956. Dropped. President Donald Trump's $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS over his leaked tax returns in exchange for the creation of a $1.8 billion taxpayer-funded anti-weaponization fund to compensate those who allege they were unfairly targeted by the Biden administration. Died, former Massachusetts representative and champion of gay rights, Barney Frank, at 86, May 19, according to reports. Sold, Jackson Pollock's number 7A, 1948, widely considered one of the first abstract paintings, at auction for a record $181 million, May 18, and discovered a 2,000-year-old mummy with a papyrus fragment of Homer's Iliad by archaeologists from the mission of the University of Barcelona, the university said, April 20. The Chiefs' logo that is usually on the field, the playing field, is an arrowhead because it's Arrowhead Stadium. Okay, the brief news. Good question. What is in the Pentagon's newly released UFO files by Jeffrey Kluger? May 8, President Donald Trump ordered the release of more than 170 files on a Department of Defense website that included reported eyewitness accounts of unidentified flying objects, or what are now more decorously known as unidentified anomalous phenomena, UAPs. Some of the accounts are from lay folk, some are from commercial pilots, some from Navy pilots who have captured videos through their windshields of what appear to be alien craft bobbing and hovering in ways no known aircraft can manage. Here are some of the most intriguing examples of the reports, sure to generate speculation, but at this point likely to remain a mystery. August 9, 1952. In a teletype labeled Urgent, addressed to then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, two employees of the DuPont Chemical Plant in Savannah River, South Carolina, reported seeing a blue light with an orange fringe shaped like a saucer. It made its appearance at 9:30 p.m., flying at a high rate of speed and traveling in a northeastern direction. The message did reach Hoover, and 2 days later he responded with a "not my department" demural. Inasmuch as the matter of the flying saucers is being investigated by the United States Air Force, he wrote, I am forwarding a copy of your letter to the Director of Special Investigations, Department of the Air Force. Another incident was more hands-on. September 27, 1950, two officers with the Philadelphia Police Department were patrolling in their squad car when they reportedly saw a 6-foot-wide object landing gently in a nearby field. The officers, upon examining it, noted it gave off a purplish glow, according to the report. After looking at the object for some time, they attempted to pick it up. The object broke, leaving a slight, odorless residue. Over a period of about 25 minutes, it completely disintegrated. Commercial airline pilots have filed sightings, too. August 4, 1947, a Pan American airliner flying the route from Gander, Newfoundland, to LaGuardia Field in New York City said they came upon a flying, gold-colored cylinder about 15 feet long. One of the pilots estimated the speed of the object at about 175 miles per hour, and it was traveling in an easterly direction, according to the file. The other pilot then spotted a similar object on the other side of the plane. The sightings continued for 90 seconds before the object vanished. A report was even filed by the Gemini 7 mission. December 4, 1965, after the spacecraft reached orbit, the crew separated from the upper stage booster and turned around to face that spent segment. The astronauts, Commander Frank Borman and pilot Jim Lovell, saw not just the upper stage, but also another, larger object they could not explain. We have a bogey at 10 o'clock high. This is an actual sighting, called Borman. In a scribbled note that is part of the document dump, a NASA official wrote the words, UFO sighting by Borman. It is the naval aviator sightings, however, that are generating the most buzz because they have video evidence to back them up. The document tranche includes a January 1, 2020 encounter with the video included online of a bright dancing point moving erratically spotted by the pilot of an aircraft patrolling the skies over the Middle East. The object lingered in sight for 1 minute and 3 seconds before it disappeared. Even more striking was the sighting on New Year's Day, 2024, of a football-shaped body with 3 fin-like projections, 1 pointing vertically and 2 pointing downward at 45-degree angles. That object remained visible for just 9 seconds before disappearing. Perhaps most sensational of all, however, were the fresh details about a 1 minute, 46-second appearance in 2013 of an 8-pointed star-like body swerving and maneuvering in front of a naval jet, leaving a fine contrail of exhaust behind it. All of the reports in the files remain objects of speculation and will be followed by more such reports, which the Department of Defense promises will be forthcoming on a rolling basis. If the UAPs are out there, the American public will have the opportunity to learn about them. All right, here's a photograph of something. It's very dim and dull looking. It's not very large either. It's in black and white and gray. And the caption reads, "A football-shaped UAP seen by a U.S. naval aviator in the skies near Japan." Well, the background is gray, and then there are blocks of black, which may be having something to do with the videotape. And then in the center, encased like in parentheses, except they're square-edged, is the blob that is sort of football-shaped. I don't think it's football-shaped. It looks more like rocket-shaped to me, with a rounded end, and then the fins on the end. Or it even looks more like a fish than a football. It's as if you were seeing a whale from the air looking down at it in the ocean. That's what it looks like to me. Okay. Oh, turning the page again. I'll read this photo caption first because it's large. It's about half a page. And it's in color, and it features 3 people. All are wearing the face masks that people wear to avoid contamination. There's a big water container in the center of the photo. It backs up to a wall. I don't know how many gallons it would hold. It's on a stand. It's not on the ground. It's on a stand, and there is a spigot on it. So there's a person. It looks like a young person, maybe a half-grown individual, washing his or her hands at this big water container. That person has a shaved head and is, again, wearing a face mask. And there's a person to the right. It looks like an adult male wearing regular plaid shirt and dark pants and a yellow vest, a black cap, and a black face mask. And that person is holding a small implement. It looks kind of like a flashlight, up against the forehead of the person rinsing his or her hands. And then behind the person rinsing his or her hands is an adult female wearing a peach and white colored outfit, and she too is wearing a face mask. And here's the caption, "Temperature check at a border crossing between Uganda and Democratic Republic of Congo." The text is written by Nandika Chatterjee. The bulletin, WHO, WHO declares global Ebola emergency. The World Health Organization declared a fast-moving Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, and Uganda a public health emergency of international concern. On May 17, after the virus killed nearly 90 people and spread across an area blighted by conflict, WHO officials said the outbreak did not meet the criteria for a pandemic emergency, but warned of a high regional risk owing to population movement, porous borders and ongoing transmission in multiple health zones. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he was deeply concerned about the scale and speed of the epidemic. In a briefing at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, May 19, by then the number of deaths had risen to more than 130 and suspected cases to at least 500. Health officials and the outbreak was being driven by the Bundibugyo strain of Ebola, a rare variant first identified in Uganda in 2007. The strain has been reported in two previous outbreaks, but has no approved virus-specific therapeutics or vaccines. The virus is transmitted through direct contact with bodily fluids, including blood, vomit, and other contaminated materials, and becomes contagious once symptoms appear. Those symptoms can include fever, vomiting, diarrhea, muscle pain, and internal or external bleeding. Initial laboratory tests were not capable of detecting the Bundibugyo strain, delaying confirmation of the outbreak, according to the WHO. Violence in eastern Congo, including attacks by armed groups such as the Allied Democratic Forces and M23, has limited access for health workers and disrupted contact tracing efforts, the WHO said. Officials noted only a small fraction of suspected cases have been confirmed in laboratories so far, highlighting uncertainty about the outbreak's true scale. The WHO's declaration, its second highest alert level, is intended to mobilize international coordination, funding, and response capacity. The agency urged countries to strengthen surveillance, isolate confirmed cases, and monitor contacts for up to 21 days, while discouraging border closures that could drive cases underground. But the global response system is hampered by the shuttering of the U.S. Agency for International Development, which played a central role in containing previous Ebola outbreaks, and the withdrawal of the U.S. from the WHO in January. The DRC has experienced at least 17 Ebola outbreaks since the virus was first identified in 1976. The largest outbreak from 2018 to 2020 killed nearly 2,300 people. The Brief Health, Five Ways to Get More Out of Your Daily Walks by Angela Haupt. As far as exercise routines go, walking seems fairly straightforward. You put one foot in front of the other and keep going till you reach your destination or decide you've had enough. Yet how you walk, your pace, posture, stride, even what's on your feet, shapes how much you actually get out of it. People take walking for granted and don't recognize the inherent power in doing it correctly, says Milica McDowell, a physical therapist and co-author of the new book, Walk, Rediscover the Most Natural Way to Boost Your Health and Longevity, One Step at a Time. From a big-picture perspective, doing it well amps up your benefits and reduces your risk of problems. In fact, walking speed has been called a sixth vital sign, McDowell says, a metric clinicians should hold in as high a regard as your heart rate, your breathing rate, your oxygenation, and your body temperature. Research suggests slower gait speed is associated with an increased risk of developing dementia, sometimes years before diagnosis. Footwear is another blind spot. Research has found that more than 60% of adults wear shoes that are the wrong size, often because they assume their feet stop changing the day they stop growing taller. That is a huge misconception, McDowell says. Walking correctly will help ensure you can do America's favorite form of exercise for as long as possible. Research suggests walking roughly 8,700 steps a day cuts the risk of dying from any cause by 60%, compared with walking 2,000 steps daily, and it is particularly good at guarding against heart disease. So, what is standing between you and those benefits? We asked experts how to get more out of your walks. Number one, increase your pace. A leisurely stroll might feel relaxing, but it is a missed opportunity for your health. To check your pace, McDowell suggests a quick self-test. Count your steps for 15 seconds. Multiply by 4 to get your steps per minute. Most people walk around 100 steps per minute, she says, but the bigger health benefits, fat burning and cardiovascular gains, kick in around 120 to 130. Watch your arms. Walking with your hands clasped behind your back is a surprisingly bad habit. If you were to lose your balance and start to fall, it's very difficult to fall safely, McDowell says. It also throws off your posture and often produces a shuffling gait that makes tripping more likely. The best practice is to let your arms swing freely, and your torso and lower body will follow. 3. Replace your shoes. Walking shoes are good for around 300 to 400 miles, and a lot of us, myself included, let our shoes go too long, says Dr. David Sabgir, a cardiologist and founder of the nonprofit Walk with a Doc. That can lead to foot, knee, and back problems. To check for a clue that you are walking correctly in supportive shoes, flip your sneakers over. A healthy wear pattern looks like the number 7, angling from the outer heel toward the big toe. 4. Pay attention to your toes. The strength of your big toe is a decent predictor of whether you will fall as you age. Research has linked weaker big toe flexion strength, your ability to press the toe firmly into the ground, to poorer balance and a higher fall risk. The toe is also responsible for propulsion, the final push that drives each step forward. A test McDowell calls toe yoga gives clues about your toe strength. Sit barefoot in a chair, lift just your big toe while the other 4 stay flat on the floor, and then reverse it. Big toe down, little toes up. Most people can't do that, she says, but even practicing for a week, people start to notice a difference. 5. Find some hills. Walking is a category of a bunch of moves, says biomechanist Katie Bowman, and trotting down flat sidewalks at one speed misses most of them. She recommends seeking out hills whenever you can, or finding a curb and practicing walking with 1 foot up and 1 down. The payoff is not just cardiovascular. Uneven terrain challenges balance and body awareness in ways flat pavement cannot. I'm not supposed to do this, but I'm going to editorialize and add a 6th category. Pay attention to your socks. Get good, sturdy, thick socks that fit well in your very well-fitting shoes. Here's the cover story. Having a brawl with a 2-page photo spread, again featuring Dana White, and it's in black and white and shades of gray, and it's just his face, or rather it's his whole head, but he looks the same as on the cover. Dana White has built the UFC into a force so powerful, it is staging a fight at the White House. By Sean Gregory, Las Vegas and Miami, and also somebody else's reporting here, with reporting by Simone Shaw. This is a long article. I may abridge it. Dana White marches in lockstep with President Donald Trump into a downtown Miami arena as Kid Rock's song, American Badass, blares over the loudspeakers. The longtime boss of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, UFC, dressed in his signature all-black attire, maintains a steely glare as Trump waves, shakes hands, raises a fist, soaking in the adulation to American featherweights Cub Swanson and Nate Landwehr, are kicking off the UFC 327 main card at the Kaseya Center on this mid-April Saturday night, and Trump snaps a photo with Swanson's wife Kenda and their three children, 8-year-old daughter Royal, 7-year-old twin sons King and Saint, by the Octagon. Within minutes, Trump's Vice President J.D. Vance will tell the world that after 21 hours of talks in Islamabad, officials failed to reach a deal to end the war with Iran. But this will not alter Trump's plans for the evening. A bona fide UFC buff, Trump settles into his cage side seat next to White to view the fight on the blood-stained mat in front of them, surrounded by, among others, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and several family members. Trump stares bluntly as Swanson and Landwehr go at it. Swanson's children to the president's immediate left do not. Royal buries her head in Kenda's armpit. Saint, on the verge of tears, covers his mouth with his hands. King clasps his head, ready to shield his eyes if need be. "I mean, look at this, SH space T," White says to me. "Imagine being these little kids and seeing your dad do this." In these moments, the brutal nature of mixed martial arts, MMA, a sport involving a ruthless combination of punching, kicking, and grappling, is not lost on White. He says one of his proudest achievements is that no one has died during a UFC competition. MMA was once considered so savage that at the turn of the century, unlike pornography and other controversial fare, it was not even carried on pay-per-view in many places. Now the UFC is so mainstream that CBS, a network that on Saturday nights once aired Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, is showing Swanson Club Landwehr's cranium with his right hand, knocking him out in the first round. The crowd erupts. The kids are all smiles. Trump congratulates the Swanson family. And the surreal nature of that, of what White has built, sets in. The UFC packs arenas around the world. And the most powerful person on the planet, right beside White, is its promoter-in-chief. "What a scene," says White, 56. "There are some nights I'll get up at the end and go, what the F space CK do I do for a living?" He is about to experience another such evening. June 14, Flag Day, and Trump's 80th birthday. The UFC is staging an event on the South Lawn of the White House, a spectacle that will also serve as the unofficial opening of a summer-long celebration of America's 250th anniversary, dubbed UFC Freedom 250. The card features American Justin Gaethje taking on the UFC's second-ranked pound-for-pound fighter, Ilia Topuria of Georgia, in the main event. It also serves as a career capstone for White, whose clout is only growing both inside and outside the octagon. White not only leads a $1.5 billion operation, he also played a key role in Trump's 2024 presidential campaign, introducing him at the 2024 Republican National Convention and helping him reach young male voters. Whether or not you admire White's unfiltered, profane leadership style, or his unapologetic embrace of the masculinity now synonymous with Trump's brand, you cannot deny he is at the peak of his powers. UFC Freedom 250 could very well bring more fans into his tent, even as critics question whether this is the moment for it. Thank God they are focused on the priorities of all Americans, wrote California Governor Gavin Newsom on X after the White House touted the fight last September. Dissenters will shout louder as fight night inches closer, especially if the Iran war drags on and gas prices stay high. Plus, there are the optics brawling at the home of the president, risks coming across less as a tribute to America's fighting spirit than as a hearkening back to the Roman gladiators fighting to the death to entertain the emperor. A celebration of sanctioned violence in this milestone moment could, to some, symbolize American crass, not class. Trump and White have long had mutually beneficial relationship. White moved to Las Vegas in 1995 because, in his telling, associates of notorious Boston mobster Whitey Bulger were attempting to extort him. He had lived in Sin City as a kid, starting after fourth grade when his single mother moved him and his sister there from New England, but had left to stay with relatives and finish high school in Maine because of his tumultuous relationship with his mom. After quitting his job as a Boston bellhop when he was around 19 and linking up with a local former Golden Gloves champion who taught him the boxing business, he returned. He was working as a manager for a few fighters when he learned that the UFC, which was founded in 1993 with no weight classes and minimal rules, was on the verge of bankruptcy. He convinced an old high school classmate, Lorenzo Fertitta, and his older brother, Frank, who had taken over their father's casino operation, that the MMA organization could thrive in a world where boxing was in disarray. White persuaded them to buy the UFC for $2 million in early 2001, and they installed him as president. White's first fight in the role, UFC 30, in February 2001, was held at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, New Jersey. John McCain, the Republican senator from Arizona, had famously labeled the UFC human cockfighting, so it was not fashionable to take a chance on the organization. That first night I went home, I said, "This is the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen," says Trump. "The punishment, you know, it's violent, but when I look at some of these other things, like the bare-knuckle stuff, it's not that violent." As the UFC grew, Trump sent White occasional notes of encouragement. The same year, Trump asked White to talk at the Republican National Convention. "He's a very good speaker, very inspirational type speaker," says Trump. "I know guys who are successful, they can't speak." White's circle advised him to turn Trump down. Everybody said, don't do it," says White. It was about more than "you don't want to get into politics." The bigger one was, he's never going to win. And I was like, well, whether he wins or not, the guy's been a good friend to me. Going into the 2024 election, White helped broker appearances for Trump on shows popular with young men, connecting him with the Nelk Boys, Will Compton and Taylor Lewin of Bussin' with the Boys, Aidan Ross, Theo Vaughn. "I had this philosophy, if that he stayed on Fox News, he could not win the election," says White. "How significant was White to the campaign?" "Very important," Trump says. "He introduced me to people I never heard of, young kids. I mean, I was being interviewed by 20-year-old kids. I'm saying, where the hell did you meet these people? They're called influencers. But I did a lot. I became friendly with some of them. They're nice kids, and they do have a big audience. And everything helps." Then White caught the big kahuna. For 8 years, he'd been asking Joe Rogan, who's been calling UFC bouts since 2002, to have Trump guest on his wildly influential podcast. Finally, Rogan relented. Trump spent 3 hours with Rogan, October 2024, a conversation that now has more than 62 million views on YouTube. Rogan offered Kamala Harris a slot, too. Harris later said she regretted passing. The decor in White's spacious office at UFC headquarters in Las Vegas is, well, striking. There's an X-rated Japanese photograph and samurai swords from the 1600s rust on a coffee table. There's an encased AK-47 and a grenade in another area. In the magazine of the assault rifle, which is wrapped in $1 bills, are items humans kill for, such as cocaine, diamonds, and gold. Across the room are two pistols. One barrel is cloaked in a red Bible cover, the other in a black one. Those two books have killed more people than any handgun ever made, says White. I'm very anti-religion. Cigars, guitars, sports memorabilia, they're all there. I am unapologetically masculine, White says. Men, in White's mind, never split the bill when out to dinner with a woman. Men do not shirk family responsibilities, and they never, ever vocalize their mental health struggles. Talking about it publicly, I just feel like it opens the door to make young men think it's okay to just F-U-C-K-I-N-G go. Oh, I'm having mental health issues, White says in a mock whiny voice. Handle it behind closed doors. Don't show that weakness to anybody. And don't call any of this talk toxic. What is toxic masculinity, says White. Who has it? Who's too masculine? I suggest that when this attitude begets unjustified violence, you can call it toxic too. Then you're a douchebag, says White. There's a difference between being a douchebag and being masculine. New Year's Eve 2022, White and his wife Anne were caught on video slapping each other during an altercation. Both expressed contrition about the incident. It's just one of those things where you have to look at yourself and blame nobody but you, says White. How the F space CK did that happen? And how do we make sure that never happens again? Strange as it may sound, White talks about insects several times in our conversations. The UFC has had only one outdoor fight in its history in Abu Dhabi in 2010, and it was humid and apparently buggy. Imagine fighting and you got bugs flying in your mouth or in your nose, says White. But at least one fighter seems unfazed. There could be a snake in the middle of the cage. I won't even see it, says Gaetia. Whatever bug bites me will bite him. The fight will feature other quirks, including, surprisingly enough, the national anthem. Out of respect to the international composition of the UFC's fighters and its host countries, bouts have already been held in England, Australia, and Mexico this year, and cards in Macau, Azerbaijan, and Serbia are on the 2026 schedule. White does not play the Star Spangled Banner or any country's anthem at the UFC bouts. An exception will be made at the White House. Fighters will warm up in the Eisenhower Executive Office building and shower back at their hotels. The main event competitors are set to walk out from the Oval Office. And while most fans will not enjoy access to West Wing restrooms, White is promising high-class temporary facilities for the 4,000-plus spectators. We are bringing in real bathrooms, he says. When the White House fight lineup was released in March, some UFC fans complained the card lacked real star power. Where was McGregor? He was not ready for the DC card and will fight at UFC 329 July 11. What about John Bones Jones? I have to build a car to people I'm confident in and I believe will show up to fight, says White. And John Jones is the least dependable guy you could ever know. Jones has pulled out of several scheduled bouts over the years. He has said he was lowballed in White House fight negotiations. Analysts cite a dearth of superstar fighters as an ongoing business concern. White stands by the lineup, arguing the emerging athletes at the White House could break out. He did make one change at Trump's suggestion, however. In Miami, Trump wondered why American heavyweight Derek Lewis, a fan favorite, was not on the card. White immediately asked Lewis and matched him with fellow American Josh Hokett. While Hokett's heel act can wear thin, his thrilling victory at UFC 327 won the respect of hardcore fans. No women are fighting at the White House. White says he wanted to set a title bout between Zhang Weili of China and Mackenzie Dern, the American-Brazilian fighter. A Chinese athlete would increase the international audience of the card, which also includes fighters from Brazil, France, and Canada. But according to White, Zhang is taking time off from fighting. We did try to make a women's fight, says White. We couldn't get it done. A representative for Zhang did not respond to requests for comment. Even staunch UFC supporters have wondered if the White House hype is worth it. Rogan, who will be in D.C. calling the fight, referred to it as a gimmick on his podcast. At first I thought that's not nice, says Trump. Then I realized it's a gimmick. Life's a gimmick, if you think about it right, but it's a good gimmick. It's something that will never happen again. Nobody will ever have the privilege of doing something like this in front of the White House. It's going to be very unique. It's going to be amazing. I think it's great for America, frankly. More than 4 hours later, past 12:30 a.m., Trump has left the premises, and White has concluded his postcard press conference. As White works his way through the bowels of the arena, UFC Freedom 250, still more than 2 months away, is front of mind. Now we go in and start building all the bells and whistles, he says. We've got to get it all dialed in. Then we have to execute that night. We're putting on the most historic sporting event in history, and now we have to deliver. We will absolutely, positively deliver. And that was somewhat abridged. The View, Society, How to Fix the Internet, by Hank Green, who is a YouTuber and co-founder of Complexly. I'm going to tell you something embarrassing. For a long time, I thought the Internet would immediately make society better. How could it not? A world where everyone was more connected would be a world where everyone was more empathetic. The gatekeepers would fall. There would be more access, more expertise, more chances for curiosity to be rewarded. This is not what happened. There are good parts, of course. We really did get access to many lifetimes' worth of high-quality information, but it turns out the information does not matter that much. Once we had infinite content, what mattered more than anything else was which bits were easiest to pay attention to. An entire professional class of content creators emerged, whose job was to figure out how to make their little video more engaging, watchable, and unignorable than the next. We entered an attention arms race, and we did it with the help of recommendation algorithms designed to amplify even the tiniest difference in the ability of a piece of content to hold your attention. As a YouTuber, I too try to capture people's attention. I make a lot of educational and pro-social content, but our systems are not designed to reward it. Our social media ecosystem cannot consistently measure how true something is. All the algorithms know is whether you click, or on the newer platforms, whether you keep watching what is served to you. The issue, paying attention, is not the same thing as understanding. In fact, a lot of the time it's in direct conflict with understanding. The result, a media environment that slices the world into the simplest possible shapes, heroes and villains, panic and certainty, fear and superiority, danger and outrage. When you feed a piece of information into the social media salience machine, it always comes out worse. But I have found a bit of hope in an unusual place. In the 1890s, the newspaper business changed. Cheap printing, telegraph wires, and easier distribution were powerful technologies for which we did not have a strong set of social norms. It became more profitable for a paper to focus on growth rather than being useful to a loyal set of readers. And getting bigger often meant publishing more stories that were more arresting, more scandalous, more emotionally loaded. What grabbed readers' attention? Crime, vice, corruption, foreign danger, social collapse. Meanwhile, newspaper barons with names like Hearst and Pulitzer got fabulously wealthy. But this era of yellow journalism did not last forever. It burned hot, warped incentives, did real damage, but then over time, consumers began to prioritize credibility. People got tired of yellow journalism. In response, newspapers began focusing on building trusted brands. That article was abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.